Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
He's PJ.
Hello there. How's it going?
I'm the Dean, and we are the Books Boys.
Sure, let me tell you, Dean, about the other day. Sure, I was talking to Jimmy. Uncle Michael, can you please leave the car? Sure, look, I would like to join the show. Uncle Michael, please, this is a very serious show about books. Is it about a good book? Is it about a good book, Dean? Is it?
It's not. It's about some good books. It's about some good books, I can tell you.
Sure. I wouldn't approve of that sort of thing at all, but I might leave now. All right, Uncle. Look, just take a seat. Drink your paracetamol there. All right.
Well, we managed to make it to episode 10 before we had your character work, so that's good. This is the Books Boys show. Get it? Buy it? Books.
Books. What's it all about?
Well, people know what the books are now because we've made it so long. I think they figured out that it's a readable papyrus object with some words on it. Right. I think people are getting it, you know?
Episode 10. It's taken 10 episodes. I'm still deeply confused of the moral nature.
I think I'm coming along as well. I mean, now I can read a book. I almost know all the letters. It's brilliant.
What? That's mad.
Almost all the letters now. So it's great, you know?
That's mad.
Well, I thought we could mix up our order a little bit this month, PJ. Instead of me doing all my books and then you doing all your books, I thought since we've read three each, we could do like one and one. We could take it in turns.
Awesome. Let's do that, dude. Yeah, totally. Well, I'm very excited about the books I read this month, let me tell you.
So am I, to be fair. Well, I'm excited about one of the three that I read. But we are joined this month by little Cheep the bird on the webcam for no one to see from us.
Apart from us, I like it. Sweet.
And a little shout out to everyone on the TNC network and everyone listening on the radio, particularly in Oxford as well. So I'm going to start with my first book, PJ. I read, right. Now, to be fair, I thought I was only going to read one book this month because my first book was The Count of Monte Cristo.
Which is supposed to be a nice paperback thriller, right?
No, it's 1,200 pages. And it's a great book, and it is kind of a page turner, but it's slow going as well, just because of the sheer length. You know, it's almost just under 1,200 pages. It's by Dumas, who we've reviewed before with some of his Three Musketeers books. Going to be honest, right off the bat, I need to say two things. This is an amazing book, but it's not as good as the Three Musketeers. So I'm just going to say that straight away. No, it's a second. You know, it's good. It's just not quite there. It lacks some of the romanticism and the swashbucklery of the Three Musketeers. But
some people love it more than Three Musketeers. Like
I mean a lot of people actually do, but for me, just not quite. And it was written at the same time, like the exact same time as the Three Musketeer trilogy. They were written like alongside each other. Yeah.
That's mad. Okay, so it's mixing universes and everything, or is it set in the same literary universe?
There's no references to make that clear. But it could be. You know, there's nothing that to make it impossible either. You know, give you the backstory, this is set during that period of time where you know the Emperor Napoleon had essentially been been kicked out of France, but was trying to come back and did in fact make a brief comeback before, you know, being finally kicked out again by the royals. So that's the historical framework for this novel. Look, I don't want to give spoilers. We never give spoilers for the end. It's tricky with a book so long because, like, I have to say something and I have to maybe go into it a little bit. I'll try not to give too much away. But to be honest, it's impossible to recap because there's just so many characters and there's so much going on. You know, it's impossible to recap in 10 minutes, you know?
It would take two episodes. I mean, we'd have to talk about for the next 2 months then.
I think so, yeah. Wow. So what we have is we have this chap, Edmond Dantès. And he's a naive little chap and he's in love with a Catalan fisherwoman girl thing. And that's grand as far as it goes. But then there's some mischievous chaps. So there's a guy, Danglars, who just doesn't like him for reasons unknown. Just doesn't like him. Okay. Then there's Cadmus, who's just, you know, Danglars' sort of associate. And he doesn't particularly like him. He doesn't particularly dislike him either. He just kind of goes along with things. And then there's Fernand, who is in love with Dante's betrothed. So they, right at the beginning, they hatch a plot and basically say, let's get this guy in jail, let's get rid of Dante's. So they get him put in jail, and of course, you know, in this society, he's put in a dungeon, a dark dungeon for life with no trial, and that's it.
Yeah. Right, okay.
So they say he's a supporter of Napoleon, let's just get rid of him, done. He does have a chance at survival. So go ahead.
No, again, there's like the theme of revenge, isn't it? That's very common in Dumas' Pair's novel too.
Yes, it is. There's a chap called Villefort who is the procureur de roi. So actually, he has the opportunity to... He's the legal boss, essentially. He has the opportunity to free Dantès or to at least look into it. But to protect his own career, he doesn't bother. Because it turns out the letter Dantès was about to deliver, unknowingly, was to Napoleon and was or to an advisor of Napoleon and was was involved with Villefort's father, who was actually a traitor to the realm. Essentially, he was a bad guy as far as his son was concerned. So to hush it up, he lets Dantès just stay in jail, rot in prison, and no one thinks anything of it. They don't see him for, you know, 20 years or whatever. They think this guy's rotted in prison and died. But he makes friends with an abbé in prison. They burrow into each other's rooms, and this little deckhand learns so much from the abbé because he was a very learned man, and he teaches him everything. And he eventually escapes prison as a very, very highly educated person,
right?
And with millions and millions and millions of wealth that the monk had hidden or knew about that it was hidden. Yeah. On the island of Monte Cristo. So Monte Cristo's it is an island, but there is no Count of Monte Cristo. He just makes himself the Count by being very rich and living on the island, essentially. But then it all gets a bit weird. You know, that first part, up until now, that could almost have been a standalone book. You know, and then we move into the second kind of sphere, which is, you know, about three quarters of the length. And what we have is all sorts of intricate stuff. So he no longer goes by Dantès. He goes by the Count of Monte Cristo. No one really knows his real name. He's just the Count of Monte Cristo.
So no one knows that this guy... So he just completely has hidden away his former identity. Does anyone know?
No, well, almost no. Okay. But he also has two other aliases. He's also Lord Winter and the Abbé Busconi. So when people say, like, who is this Count of Monte Cristo? Has he got any, you know, credentials established? Oh, yes, he's a good friend of the Abbé Busconi. And, so he sets up his own credentials with, like, a series of false identities, essentially.
Clever. Nice.
And he has some servants. He has a female slave, Greek, called Haiti, but he doesn't treat her like a slave. He treats her almost like a goddess. Like, he is very, very good to her. Then he also has Ali and Bertuccio. Now, I don't want to get into massive details because, as I say, it's impossible. But basically what happens is there's these two chaps, Albert and Franz, that he befriends, these two young chaps, but they're suspicious of him. One of them, at least, is suspicious of him. And he they're in Rome and they're hanging around in Rome. And then they eventually say, let's meet the Count of Monte Cristo in Paris. We've got to bring it back to Paris, you know. So they meet him there. He arrives and... there's so many characters, it's difficult to say, but basically he sets out on a plot to get revenge on all the people who harmed him and who put him in prison. So that's Danglars, that's Fernand, that's Villefort. And he does this, you know, but towards the end, he loses his own morality and there's actually some soul searching that goes on. But there's also these amazing, massive Hollywood movie dramatic reveals. You know, each time he finally reveals his real identity to someone and they're, you know, in shock, quaking in their boots, you know, because he goes through, he sets up these really intricate traps for them. And, but this man, they think he's a vampire at one point because he's like emotionless and cold, but, you know, perfect, you know, aristocracy, essentially, you know, and very pale from his time in the dungeon as well. And they find it like his manners are impeccable. It's difficult to reproach him, but there's something just strange about this chap. And they just can't, they don't know what to say. You know, there's something weird about him.
And that attracts you, doesn't it? That whole kind of Dracula kind
of. Yes, it does. But guess what? This book is full of weird Victorian coincidences that make it a little bit hard to believe. Because he gets in Paris, who does he make friends with? Well, Danglars is there and he's now a baron and he's doing very well. The Count de Morcerf, the father of Albert. Oh, hold on. It just turns out that that's Fernand, and Albert's mother is the Catalan that he'd fancied all those years ago. And she maybe recognizes him, but we're not sure. And then it just so turns out that Villefort is there, and that Franz is engaged to Villefort's daughter, Valentine. So everything's just coming together. And then it turns out that Madame Danglars and Villefort had an illicit love child, and they tried to kill the baby. And who would come in and rescue? Only Bertuccio, the servant. So, there's just so many. And then that son grows up to be someone that the Count then meets and introduces to people. And there's just so many coincidences, and everyone knew everyone else, and no one knows who anyone else is. It's almost farcical at times.
Oh my God. All right. So, it's just he's not really bothering too much with realism. All right. Fair enough. Yeah.
But it's an amazing, amazing, amazing book. I can't fault it. I honestly maybe it could have been shorter, but
no, it sounds epic. I mean, it just sounds like why shorter? I mean, people nowadays watch huge long, you know, Netflix series or whatever, or they watch The Wire seasons 1 to 980 or whatever. You know what I mean? I feel like long is good. You know, why not?
I suppose it is. It is. Yeah. And I mean, I read this. It didn't take me a month in the end. It took me 15 days. So I did it in half the time I was meant to. Yeah. And there's bands of brigands and there's all sorts. There's this bit where Albert's captured by brigands. And of course, the Count of Monte Cristo just happens to have influence over the brigands so he can rescue him. He can do anything, this guy. You want anything done, he can just do it anywhere in the world, you know. And the chap, this is amazing. This is the kind of character I love. He's rescued by, he's captured by brigands. He doesn't care. He just goes in and goes to sleep. And everyone's like, well, normally people are begging and whatever and screaming. This guy just goes in calmly and goes to sleep. And they wake him up and they say, you're free. And he says, why have you woken me up to tell you you're free, Your Excellency? And he said, in the future, never awaken a man this early in the morning. I would still have been free in a few hours' time if you'd waited. You know, he's just so relaxed, does not care.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's awesome. So it's got some real great characters, right?
It does. And there's this old guy, Noirtier, Villefort's father, who's old and disabled and cannot speak. But Valentine can communicate to him through a series of blinks and winks and, you know, this kind of thing. it's insane, you know. But you've got these really mean characters, you know, like Villefort and Danglars. Some of the coincidences are a bit hard to come by. But he goes through his revenge, you know, so beautifully. And there's a part at the end where he almost can't believe himself, you know, and he's rich man, rediscover the poor man you were, free man, rediscover the prisoner, resurrected man, remember the corpse, because he's losing himself to revenge. And he actually almost doesn't recognize himself anymore.
Wow. Okay. Wow, I mean, I do love the theme of revenge. I mean, you know, if you ever watched, for example, Park Chan-wook's Old Boy, it's a great Korean
Yes,
movie.
I have.
Exactly, it was a similar, not necessarily a similar story, but it's the same kind of thing where they trick someone and they prison him for years and take him away from his daughter, and then he just comes out seeking revenge. And I mean,
Yeah.
obviously, you got the story a thousand times in Hollywood or whatever. Or Breaking Bad is a great example. But I mean, yeah, I mean, this must be one of the first real huge epic revenge until everyone's kind of like
I
ruined
think
this
it
character.
has to be. There's
Until
only
you ruined
one.
yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, there's only one other thing I want to say about it. There's another family called the Morells, and they're like the only good family in the book.
Okay.
And they were the ones who originally employed Dantes on the boat. And the dad's dead now, but he meets their son, and he does some mysterious things where he helps them out of a financial difficulty and saves the life of the father. And the father suspected it was Dantes, but didn't tell anyone. And we find out much, much, much later that he suspected it and told them before he died. And then, you know, by mysterious coincidences, he ends up rendering the same assistance and preventing the son from committing suicide 20 years to the date, to the exact date that he prevented the father. You know, there's a lot of
Oh,
this
wow.
romantic coincidence going on.
Okay.
But they're the only people that think they recognize him. They think, you know, there's
All
something about
right.
this guy because they're good. And they're the only people who are not so self-absorbed as to not recognize
Wow.
someone whose life they ruined. You know, these good
Oh my God.
people remember him, or but they're not sure and they don't tell him, but they have a suspicion.
And tell me this. Yeah, and their family name is Morales, right? So it's kind of like saying that they have morality in them.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
tell me this though. It's written in the 40s, right? 1840s.
Yes,
And
1840s.
so, I mean, technically, that would be a realist kind of era, but it sounds a very kind of romantic sort of
It
novel.
is.
I mean, okay.
Dumas is too romantic. I mean, even
All
all
right.
the whole Three Musketeers books, they're full of romance. I mean, there's realist aspects, but no, the romance is
Yeah.
bulging through, you know. It's
Yeah, it
just
does sound like, I mean, a realist aspect might be, I mean, is it describing the society of the time pretty detailed, or is it not even bothering too much? Is it just bothering more on the revenge kind of theme?
Yeah, there is a bit of, I mean, just because of the sheer length of the book, there's a lot of different scenes. So we do
Yeah.
get to have a good look at that type of society, the rich Parisian opera-going society. You know, we almost get a little bit of Vanity Fair style where we see this kind of this rich society. So it is good to see that. But it focuses mostly on the it's a bit disjointed at times because there's just so much going on. It doesn't always flow as well as it could. But it all comes back, you know, at the end, and it gets very addictive towards the end, you know. And
Okay.
I mean, I love the big reveals and the big romantic parts, you know.
Yeah, I love it. It sounds great. Yeah, love to read it. Talking about romanticism, you know what I read this month? Well,
I
talking
think
with
I know,
Leah.
but let's have it from yourself.
We're talking to Leah Sackett last month, and her love of the Alice books, the Alice in Wonderland books, made me realize, you know what, I should give it a try, because I have given it a try at least twice in my life and didn't get into it. So I got out the my Alice Adventure in Wonderland book and started reading it, and I must say I absolutely loved it. It's such a good book. I mean, you know this. I've talked to you about this before now throughout the whole month, that I just really love the Alice's Adventures in Wonderland book. So there are two books, guys. So first of all, there is Alice Adventures in Wonderland, which was published in 1865 by Lewis Carroll, whose real name was Charles Dodgson. I can't even pronounce his name. Charles Dodgson. So anyway, you know the story about Alice. She falls through a rabbit hole and she ends up underground, but really the underground world is just featured with a lot of talking animals and, you know, kind of like two-dimensional card-like people. And really it's just it goes into the category of literary nonsense. So Lewis Carroll just really enjoyed just he enjoyed rhymes and kind of children literature, but it's so absurd that it's not absurdism. I mean, it's just kind of like, it's just what's the point of this? It's just okay, it rhymes, you know, like pie rhymes with tie or something like that. So if pie rhymes with tie and die, then he's just gonna somehow like form some kind of story with that, you know, some kind of episode. And really, it's very episodic. I have to say, it's not really strong in like plot line. That's what I think.
Really?
No, I just don't find it's a very strong plot. I mean, there is a plot, but it really just, at least the book, it really just goes from one episode to the next, episode to the next, and it seems very random and disjointed, I have to say.
Right.
But I think the point of Alice in Wonderland is more, it's more about like this child's perception of, and that her fantasy becomes reality. And you're really not sure with the story if she's kind of just imagining it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read both books, actually, you just think at the end, so did she actually dream it all? Did she imagine it all? Mm. Because it kind
maybe
of
that's
ends...
why it's disjointed then. Like a child's imaginings wouldn't be have a coherent narrative necessarily, you know?
Exactly. So it's a fascinating book for like a psychologist, you know what I mean? Like studying dreams, or especially a psychoanalyst. And yeah, this book was particularly popular by later on as well by psychoanalysts and other people interested in that. But I think, yeah, I think that's a strong point. I think the strong point here is that Carol managed to portray a child's imagination really accurately, maybe like the more accurately than anyone did before that. Not that it's the best and strongest children novel. You know my opinions about that. I still think Spiri's Heidi is the best children's novel for so many reasons. And it is, I think, sorry, but I think it's just a stronger book. But it doesn't mean that Alice in Wonderland is also a great book in a very different way. In the sense of this is a child's perspective. Heidi is just a great, really a good story that can encourage you to be a better person. Alice's Adventure in Wonderland, there's no real morality and there's not really a lesson and there's not really a plot line in my opinion. It just seems like he was just coming, you know, just writing and coming along with a story as it goes. Saying that though, this might interest you because you are the absolute expert in the theme, in the subject of logic at university.
This is true. We studied logic together in university. Yes. Good callback.
Yes, I was the worst in the class. You were the best in the class.
Somehow, yeah.
And actually, Lewis Carroll was a mathematician. And right. he really knew a lot about logic. So it seems very interesting because this book seems very unlogical. So yeah, that's what I want to say. I want to add to that I read also the second book, Through the Looking Glass.
Mm-hmm.
Through the Looking Glass, excuse me. Written in 1871. Now his dad died just before that. You know, he wasn't really in contact with the real Alice. For those of you who don't know, Alice was based on a real girl. And yeah, she's already kind of like growing up at this point. Through the Looking Glass is a lot more melancholic. It's a lot more pessimistic. There's a darker theme in it. He plays a lot. There's this theme of cards in the first book, and in the second one is chess. And right. Basically, Through the Looking Glass, she goes through to the next world, to the fantasy world, through a mirror. So it's always interesting. There's always these portals, basically, to these universe. I have to say, Through the Looking Glass might be even stronger in like this subjective state of like flowing to the next state. It's really it's a metaphor straight from the beginning that she's actually in a chess game, and that she really has no control over what she's doing, and she's just completely disjointedly going from one place to the next in order to become a queen. So she's a pawn, and she's going to become a queen. Now, in the Disney film, they mix both plots, but
I was going to ask you that because I've not read them, but I've seen the cartoon film. I was going to ask, is it based on both together?
I think it's based on both of them together, but I have to say it's been a while now since I saw it. But yeah, I think they mix both of them a lot.
Okay. So this is the stuff with the Queen of Hearts and the White Rabbit with the we're late for an important date and all of that stuff, right?
Exactly, guys. So just basically to talk about the plot, Alice Adventure Wonderland is the one that you know better probably. That she's following a rabbit, which goes down a rabbit hole, and the rabbit is late. And basically, Alice is falling down, entering this world. And in fact, she just kind of goes along with the flow, and she meets a lot of different animals that always give her a lesson. It's the same with Through the Looking Glass. So that's why I'm just mentioning now I know we're supposed to mention one book at a time, but they're very much linked.
Yeah, no, I think that's fine if they're linked. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and basically, yeah, it's quite interesting. And now you've got the Cheshire Cat. I've got to mention that.
Yes.
Who must be? It's really one of the best characters
in the movie. I find him very creepy.
He is, and he's extremely creepy in the book as well. But yeah, it's fascinating because he just appears out of nowhere. And then he's smiling, and just the fact that a cat will be smiling, and he explains that he kind of, it's kind of sad because like he explains that he's smiling when he's unhappy, and he's when he looks unhappy, he's actually very happy. So he's actually not a very happy cat. So if he were at least a happy cat, but he's not. It's just the whole universe is actually filled with very unlikable characters. I find, I have to say, I don't really think they're. Okay. I think like. Because when I, for example, wrote Okutama Express and I had a lot of animal characters, I can't help making them kind of likable, in my opinion. But in this case, it's kind of like they kind of represent a bad characteristic of humanity.
Right.
So you've got like the dodo and the white rabbit kind of like always rushing to get in time for somewhere. You've got... oh my God, you've got the dodo, you've got the caterpillar, who's just kind of, it just seems to be an opium addict, in my opinion. But you got like, you got the queen of hearts and the king of hearts, and you've got this aristocracy in there as well. And it's just basically the queen of hearts just wants to behead everyone. And then the king of hearts has to excuse her behavior. It's mad. And there's the mock turtle as well, I find. Him an interesting character.
Is this for kids or is this good for adults to read? I think that's my only question, really.
Yeah, I would say that it's definitely it's so much an adult's read, definitely.
Okay,
and it's really relaxing. I find to read it, it's just you get in, you read it one day, and it's you're left with an impression more than the story.
Okay,
and the same I can say with Through the Looking Glass. Now, Through the Looking Glass is even more adults. Focus. It's even darker. It's very pessimistic. I find even more. It's got even more bizarre characters. So there's a lot of, for example, there's Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
Yes.
And they're kind of just inseparable twins. But nevertheless, the fact that they love each other is also maybe not a healthy love because they also fight against each other and they can't be separated.
Mm-hmm.
And you got the White Knight, right? Was Leah mentioned? She actually, she
if yeah, you, she did the White Knight delivery service or
escort service, yeah,
escort service, yeah. I was confusing that with Kiki's delivery service there.
Yeah, why not delivering pizza, right? Delivering pizza, and the White Knight is just I mean, it's kind of funny. He's falling off onto his head and stuff, but there's also something kind of like said. Sadomasochistic about the novel. I think it's a very bizarre sort of kind of universe he's created that's often very creepy. And there is a lot of controversy about his life and his sexuality, you know, Lewis Carroll. So I mean, I do wonder about that in the novel, like and stuff. And so anyway, that's
awesome.
Those are
and
two books.
The big coincidence is that while you were reading these, I was in Oxford and I went to Alice's shop in Oxford at the same time you're reading. It was a weird coincidence.
Oh my God, that's crazy, yeah. Because I was really into it. I mean, I just thought, wow, amazing. Yeah, no, it's a great universe, very inspiring and creepy. Creepy, definitely. And creepy, but also kind of like just enjoyable. It's a very strange mix and just really easy to read, I find. So definitely recommend both books. Just read them one after the other. And it's just awesome, yeah.
Okay. Well, what I'll do before we move on to our next ones is we'll have a quick message from our sponsors for this month. We have two sponsors. We have the Corporation for Shorter Podcast Episodes, which you can find at shortshort.short. And it's helping us to keep our episodes concise and not 2 hours long. And also we have the Association for Picking a Pocket or Two, which we can learn all about, of course, in Oliver Twist. So those are our sponsors for this week, or this month, I should say. But of course, we do also have our real sponsor, which is the Norwood Investing LLC. And I'll put a link again, but that's an investment center focusing on becoming more financially independent, courses on trading stocks and bonds and all that kind of stuff. And they do a 1-year deal. So I'll put some info and a link on that. Sweet. on the episode as well. And that's from Danny. He's a great guy. And he's been supporting us for a while. Oh, PJ, just before we get to the next split, I think I hear the telephone ringing.
Line. Okay.
Hey, you're through to Books Boys. You got Dean and PJ on the line. Who's calling?
Hey.
Cool. It's Liam, also known as Secondhand Bookman. Yeah, so I just thought I'd ring in about a little known story by Charles Dickens called George Silverman's Explanation. I don't know if either of you two are familiar with it.
No, I haven't heard this.
I thought I had read, you know, near enough the complete works of Dickens, but I don't know that one. I read all his novels. Wow. I read any short stories I could find, but I don't know that one.
Oh my God. Yeah, all right. So you've got it. I'd love to hear it. Is that?
Yeah. I'd never heard of this story until about 2 weeks ago when I just saw it in a bookshop. And when I put a review up of it online, I also had quite a lot of Dickens fans as well saying that they'd never heard of it either.
Wow.
Which is really bizarre considering the kind of story itself. I suppose just to kind of give you a bit of history about it, it was published in 1868, so it was about 2 years before Dickens died. Mm-hmm. And it was the last complete work of fiction that he wrote. And he was just paid an extraordinary amount of money for this story. I couldn't actually find out how much he was paid for the story itself, but in terms of the publication rights, he was approached by a chap named James Fields, who was the editor at the Atlantic America at the time. And he offered Dickens £1,000 for the publishing rights for it to be published in America before England. Yeah, I mean, £1,000 sort of back then in today's money. It worked out to about 115 grand.
Wow, just to have it published in America.
And it's a really... Yeah. I mean, that's literally just the publication, right? So, I mean, I don't know how much he got paid on top of that either. And it's a really short story. I mean, it comes in at about 44 pages. I actually looked up the word count. It comes in at 11,000 words. So for the price he was paid just the publication, right? It basically worked out to about £2,500 per page he was getting paid for the story, or about £10 per word.
PJ, if we can get you paid that much for Okatama Express, you'd be doing quite well.
Yeah, if you get that for mine, that's an insane deal. Wow, that's crazy.
Absolutely ludicrous amount of money. And it's such an incredible story. I mean, it, which is why it kind of just baffles me that it just seems to fly under the radar so many sort of Dickens fans, I suppose. Because, you know, not only is it a brilliant story, it's, you know, the last piece of fiction that he completed, and he was just paid an obscene amount of money for it. But really short story, as I said, 44 pages. I mean, I don't know how kind of in depth you want me to go with the story in terms of like spoilers. I mean, do you want me to just kind of unpack it?
Our general rule is never spoil the ending, but you can kind of, you know, talk about the first kind of half to two-thirds, you know.
And I'd love to hear about the story, yeah.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Okay, well, I'll keep the ending under wraps then.
Please.
I mean, it starts off, immediately it just feels really familiar as a Dickens story. Opens up with George Silverman himself as a child living in this kind of squalid, damp cellar in Preston, really unhappy childhood, and ends up being orphaned. So immediately there's that kind of...
Okay, it's hitting all the tropes right away.
Yeah, stereotypical Dickens.
Pretty much. And, you know, he kind of leads this kind of really miserable life, even when his parents are alive, that they treat him really harshly. He keeps being accused of his mother of being sort of too worldly and wanting too many things, even when he's, you know, just asking for food and warmth. So he's living in this kind of, it's horrific. He's kind of existing in this sort of like purely kind of animalistic state, I suppose. And his parents both end up dying of fever, and he gets rescued from the cellar. A clergyman who has a fantastic name, Charity Hawkyard. And again, there's quite a few names in the story, like typical Dickens, you know, just really fantastic names. So he's kind of rescued by this clergyman, and is sort of educated and sort of brought up in this quite religious environment. and really doesn't like it. And sort of throughout the story, he's basically living with this really sort of ingrained sense of and shame, really, due to kind of just being locked up most of his life and just sort of the way his parents treated him. He just has almost no self-esteem. He just looks down on himself and just considers himself, you know, like the worst person in the world. You know, the kind of children who he's kind of brought up with, they sort of invite him to parties and he turns them down because he just doesn't feel like he's good enough. And he just really just sort of like isolates himself and just sort of sabotages his kind of chance at happiness, really. Like every time that sort of option comes along, he just, you know, blows it out of the water, really.
Okay, so he's slightly different than the, you know, it sounded like the Orphan story, it's the same as Oliver Twist, it's the same as Great Expectations, David Copperfield, but actually most of them, they're looking for a happy ending. It sounds like maybe this guy's not really even looking for a happy ending.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, he's kind of just completely alone as well. I mean, there's no sort of Joe Gargery figure like you get in Great Expectations, you know, someone to kind of like, you know, really sort of coddle him and bring him up. So he's just kind of dealing with all the stuff himself. Eventually becomes an adult and sort of goes off to sort of university or college to get educated. And, you know, continues to kind of carry this guilt around with him until he's approached by quite a wealthy woman who, and she wants him to educate her daughter. Okay. And he falls in love with the daughter. Oh, she falls in love with him as well.
Oh.
And,
mercy.
You know, I won't, you know, kind of say what happens at the end, but, you know, it is quite a sort of sad story. It, you know, it is sort of missing that kind of classic, you know, sort of like typical kind of happy ending.
Yes, that you standard get. Dickens ending.
Is absent.
Oh, no, so because in most Dickens novels, you know, just no matter how sad it gets, they all get married and live happily ever after in the end. So it's a shame if we don't get that, actually.
It sounds very existentialist and modernist, actually. It doesn't sound like Dickens novel. It sounds like something, I don't know, like Gorski would write or something like that, or Dostoevsky.
Absolutely. Wow. I mean, it's bizarre because the sort of story exists in this, in sort of two camps where, like, on the one hand, it really does feel like really familiar as a Dickens story. You know, you kind of got those classic tropes, you've got, you know, the kind of fantastic names and things like that. But then, you know, on the other hand, you know, it doesn't have that happy ending. You know, one of the most notable things missing from it is its humour. You know, it's not particularly funny, which is quite strange.
So I think Dickens lost humor. Yeah, he lost his humour near the end, I think. You know, his last couple of works, they're not really, they don't have that humour of his early stuff. You know, it's quite sad, actually.
It is such a shame. I mean, I did manage to kind of track down a quote by Dickens when he went back and read this kind of short story, and he said himself that it feels like someone else had written it, like it's fallen out of someone else's head.
Really?
So yeah, it's kind of bizarre. It's sort of really kind of Dickensian on one hand, but it's also kind of missing a lot of the kind of typical things that you'd expect to find in a Dickens story.
I have just one question for you because of its length. Does it read like a real short story, or does it read like a plan for a novel? You know, is it what he could have turned into a full novel, or is it very clear that it was always just going to be a short story?
I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I really wish it was a novel. As I said, it's about 44 pages long, and I just sort of wish it was about 444.
Yeah,
there's kind of so much potential. You know, yeah, there's basically just so much potential in there to kind of explore the character, and you know, a lot of kind of stuff in his life does get skipped over quite quickly. But I mean, you know, it still does feel like a short story. It is still enjoyable. You know, it's kind of very tight. There's not a kind of like wasted word or a syllable in it.
Well, hey, if I was getting paid $2,000 per page, I would not be wasting any words, you know.
Well, this is the sort of common criticism you find, you know, when people talk about Dickens, they all say he was paid by the word, so he just stretched everything out and everything becomes sort of so flowery, you know, which I've never agreed with personally. You know, I just never thought that, you know, Great Expectations could have benefited from, you know, taking a single word out of that novel. It's just, he, you know,
some of them could, though. You could cut a little bit out of Bleak House, I think. That's, you know, that doesn't need to be 800 pages and very little happens in it, you know. That could be cut a little bit.
Our joke is
that's fair enough.
our joke is that he took the Anna Karenina method, which was a best-selling method to make big, huge novels. So you have like a short story, and then you just put an agricultural manual around it. So I think that he was kind of going for that Tolstoy method.
If it feels like Anna Karenina gets a mention in every one of your episodes about
we
it.
Love it.
Sorry, I just had to mention it. It was on my agenda to mention it.
So. Man, thanks so much for calling in. Let's plug your Instagram. Yeah. It's Secondhand Bookman. And you're doing book reviews on there?
Yeah, Secondhand Bookman. Pretty much, yeah. Secondhand Bookman, all just sort of one word, all lowercase.
And I love your mission. So it seems like you're going, like what I get from that, but you can correct me though. What I get from that is that you go to secondhand bookshops, or you search for books that are unknown and then bring them back to life, can we say? Is that what you do?
Yes. Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm quite similar to Dean in the sense that, you know, 99% of my bookshopping is done in secondhand bookshops.
Us too, like we love that. So,
we love that. Yeah.
It's great.
Secondhand bookshops are just these kind of, these magical.
Actually, my confession is that the bookshop that I always talk about going to, like PJ introduced me to that shop. I didn't even know that shop before. So that's PJ's gift to me, actually.
There you go. The magic bookshop, we call it. Yeah. Well, next time you're in Belfast, next time you're in Belfast, we'll wake up and go there and excavate.
Awesome.
Take your shovel.
Yeah, no, that sounds absolutely wonderful.
Thanks, man.
Brilliant.
Awesome, dude.
Richard. Wow.
Yeah.
So, PJ, that was pretty cool. We had Secondhand Bookman calling in. You can check him out on Instagram. And we learned some stuff about some unknown Dickens.
Yeah, that was really interesting. My God. And I really liked the way he told his story. I mean, that was really interesting about finding this unusual book. Mm-hmm. I've never heard of it, so.
Nor had I. He's a cool guy. And we're going to hear from him again because he's gonna co-host Caper Captains with us this month.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
Let's mention that. We have every month Caper Captains, which is our murder mystery, our Agatha Christie mini episodes. And we set up the plot, and normally I set up the plot and you guess who done it. But while we're on that theme, guys, if you go to patreon.com/booksboys, you can get all of our bonus shows. We recently released Film Fellows episode 2, where we talked about Nightmare on Elm Street. And we've got interviews from the vault, where I've done decade-old interviews with rock stars and musicians. And we've got Playboys, our Shakespeare reviews, and we're going to try to get a few more of those done soon. There's a lot of stuff on there, guys. And it's only £2.50, €2.50, or $3 per month. And that's bargain. Amazing. It's very cheap. It's so cheap that we're almost paying you to take it. You know,
like we're almost paying you.
If it's any cheaper, we'll be paying you, you know?
Exactly. I mean, any cheaper, I'll be giving you money from my pockets just to open your ears,
But if you want to support us, that's a great place to do it, patreon.com/booksboys. There is a way there's two ways that you can support us for free, though. Give us a good iTunes review if you listen on iTunes. That's an easy thing to do. Or if you're on the Spotify's, listen to our albums. I've got my album out, A Dozen Most Listenable, and we've got our joint album, Dedicated Friendship. Whoa. Those are both up there on the Spotify. And all you got to do is listen. And every time you listen, we get a fraction of a penny. And if we get enough people listening in about 10 years' time, in about 10 years' time, we can afford a subscription to our own Patreon. So that's a measure of success. You know?
Exactly, guys. So just support us, you know. You know, one penny is better than half a penny, right? Much with half a penny. So I'm like, we need a few half pennies.
That's it. So those albums are on Spotify, and there's links to everything, of course, on booksboys.com. And we still have our mystery book giveaway. So if you'd like to win a mystery book, just email booksboys@hotmail.com. Tell us what you're reading. Just a couple of lines. That's all we need. PJ, the second book I read this month is, I'm going to show it to you here. It's by Johan Harry, Lost Connections. So following on from the meditation book I got last month, I thought I would try something along the same lines. It's Lost Connections, Why You're Depressed and How to Find Hope. There's not a lot to say about it because, like, you know, it's not a plot-based book. But the guy does some searching into what causes depression. The chap himself was depressed in the 80s, and he was basically told, well, your brain's broken. Take antidepressants for the rest of your life. Next. You know, and that was it. So then he says, well, that can't be right. And he spends the first... So the book's essentially split into three parts. The first part is just introductory. There's two main parts. One of those is disconnection. So that's him looking, like, what is causing disconnection? why are we feeling depressed and anxious? And it's, you know, disconnection from meaningful work, from other people, from meaningful values, childhood trauma. And he goes through it kind of various different causes. And throughout this book, and you can see this on the lostconnections.com, throughout the book, he cites a lot. It's written quite lighthearted, and bits of it, he almost writes it like a story. But then there's references to interviews with scientists and with psychologists and people working in the field. And they're all properly cited and referenced at the back of the book, and all the interviews are available to listen to online. So it's a scientific study, but it's written quite lighthearted, almost like a novel at times, to make it more engaging. You know, that's why he's an international bestseller. It's not a journal, you know. But the second half then is the ways to reconnect to other people, to meaningful work, you know, meaningful values. And there's a lot of stuff about community. And he thinks that basically the way we live today, very, very, very isolated, very selfish, and working, you know, boring jobs. And that's really not helping us as a society. And, you know, doing volunteer work and getting involved with the community and nature and this kind of stuff. You know, he thinks are essentially a cure for that, you know.
I like it.
Is a great quote. Materialism is KFC for the soul. So like this materialist capitalist world is junk food for your soul, you know, essentially.
Awesome. I like it.
I think it's an easy to read book because it doesn't read like a scientific journal, despite the fact that there is a lot of evidence quoted in it, you know. It makes it quite easy to read. And he talks a lot about his own experiences and also about the experiences of other people. But again, it's always backed up by studies. But one, you know, his big point is basically, you know, there was a time when we had rich communities, and now we have people who nod to each other and then close their door. And this, the Western world is full of disconnection, you know. And it's basically why we're disconnected and then how we can reconnect. And I find it quite peaceful and quite enjoyable to read and helpful, actually.
Great. So it actually motivated you, it actually brought you up.
I think so, yeah. I definitely would, if anyone is, you know, thinks that would be helpful to them, or even, you know, just a pure interest on depression, even if you're not depressed yourself and you're just curious. It's a short book. It's only about 300 pages. You know, I think I read it in a week, and I think that anyone could read it quite accessibly. It's quite an enjoyable read, actually, as well.
It's a big theme with me at the moment. I mean, like, I'm also investigating about how to, I wouldn't say cure depression, but how to transform depression into self-love and positivity. So wow, I'd love to read that book, definitely. Does he mention at all Blue Zones or Dan Buettner's work? Did he ever mention that in the book?
I don't. There's dozens and dozens of references. I can't remember offhand.
I'm sure he does, because Dan Buettner is just kind of a reporter. He's kind of a madman, actually. He's kind of a reporter and a cyclist, and just kind of like investigate and explore everything together. Right. And he came up with his Blue Zones concept in an article called The Secrets of a Long Life. And basically, Blue Zones are these communities around the world. There are only like five he identified, in Okinawa, in the Ikaria in Greece, Sardinia in Italy, a community in California, and a community in Nicaragua. And basically, what these communities have in common is that they are very socially active with one another. And scientists actually proven that you know, distancing yourself, feeling disconnected, just knowing to your neighbor, than isolating at home, actually reduces your life expectancy. So if you just have a strong social connection to your neighbors, then you can actually increase your lifespan. As well as that, he also talked about, like, you know, a largely plant-based diet, a slower pace. So all of these communities, they actually just do everything slower. And also that they have a sense of purpose, so that everyone knew exactly what they're doing, engagement, spirituality. There are different takes, there are different kind of reasons. But I just find it interesting I mentioned that. So like social connection and also distance is extremely important, even though we have a tendency to, like, say we want to isolate ourselves.
Yeah. I should say that, you know, in investigating this, he speaks to dozens of people and he travels the world. You know, he says, well, let's see how the Amish live. You know, let's go to somewhere across the world. Oh, let's find a community who were living where the Berlin Wall was and hear their story about how, you know, when the Berlin Wall came down, the area they were living in went from being, you know, essentially a trouble zone to being prime real estate. So they, you know, tripled their rent and they couldn't afford to live there anymore. And wow. All this kind of touching stories about like immigrants and gay communities that were both marginalized coming together and making a community and helping each other. Like there's a lot of really touching stories in it, you know?
Wow, I'd love to read it, yeah.
So it's awesome. It's very, very good. Have you got one more?
Well, before that, guys, I just want to mention that if you actually are interested in that, you can join the Holy Wholesome Life on Facebook, mm-hmm. as well as Yang Morning Meditation with PJ. So this is something I do with my partner, Lisa Fox, which is basically helping people with depression and turn that into self-love through plant-based nutrition. So if you want to check us out on Facebook, Mastermind and YouTube. Oh. And yeah.
Project section on booksboys.com, there is a link to the Holy Wholesome Life. By the time the episode goes out, I'm going to try to get a link to your YouTube channel as well so that everyone can just easily access that as well.
Thank you very much. And we always just provide free information and help. So feel free if you just want to join hands.
By the way, before you get into your book, I have a quick addendum, PJ. I've been made to apologize because last month I said, oh, when I got Trafalgar, the guy gave it to me for free because I bought so many other books in Galicia. Yeah. Actually, I didn't buy a single book. Valerie the Pigeon Detective bought all of those books. So Valerie, I've just been asked to clarify that I didn't pay for a single book myself on that trip.
All right, okay. It's on record right now. thanks, Valerie the Pigeon Detective. I appreciate your engagement. And she's basically sponsoring us, right? I mean, that's basically she's our sponsor.
Yeah. She paid half a dozen books, you know, more than that, actually, probably a dozen books so far.
Yeah. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.